on the air. And we have Fred Malone with us, who is going over all sorts of interesting stuff, including all the different evenings that the that they're going to have, the presidential evenings that they're going to have at the Marion County Historical Society. Easy for me to remember. And he's got more stuff. Let's get on it.
Okay.
All right.
We're going to talk about, again, the whole premise is best little stories from the White House.
Yeah, that great.
Necessarily don't have to be funny stories, but I think last time we talked about White House pets and
yep.
some things like that.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And I'm going to do that again a little bit today, and if we can get started on some of the early presidents. I've tried to do this with the presidents, individual presidents, chronologically.
Okay.
So when we start that, we'll start with not too much talk about Washington, but we'll start with probably Jefferson and go up.
How do you justify that this book is true to the actual facts?
Well, I have studied American history my entire life, and a lot of this information I was privy to in other publications,
yeah,
but I'd never seen it in one book.
Oh, okay.
All together.
But you do trust this author.
Yeah,
okay.
The individual that wrote this book is a historian.
Okay.
And I know their research is impeccable. So
good.
I know these stories are true.
My wife asked me that question.
Yeah, and a lot of the information that was garnered for this book is firsthand information that came from the source.
Cool.
So, and you think that information like this would not be written down somewhere, but
yeah,
it is. It really is. That's what presidential papers are all about.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important that people like Donald Trump don't walk off with 15 boxes
right.
full of presidential papers.
Well, now, when did that start? Did it start right from Washington?
Oh, early, yes. Early.
Really?
Oh, yeah. There are presidential papers from George Washington, absolutely.
So it wasn't a security thing like some people claim it
well,
is. It's more a history.
Yeah, the security portion, I think, came more when we got into the
Cold War type stuff.
Right, the
yeah.
Cold War thing,
yeah.
Right. I think that's when the security part really started to
come
into play. You know, most of these presidents had more than one secretary.
Yeah.
They had people that kept track of where they were going, where they are, what they said. That doesn't mean that some paperwork didn't get destroyed, because we know some presidents' wives burnt things, that destroyed things. But for the most part, most information of presidencies from the beginning have been pretty well chronicled and kept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
So I thought first today I wanted to finish up on a couple of things that I wanted
right.
to talk about the last time that we didn't get to.
All right.
And this first one, we talked about the pets and I think maybe who was born in the White House, that type of thing. This one is just generally speaking a progress report on things that went on in the White House. And I'm taking this information directly from the book, so bear with me.
Stay close to the microphone,
you know,
though.
A lot of things happened. A lot of things happened in that executive mansion. We know that the executive mansion, the construction of the executive mansion, started when Washington was president, but he never spent a night in the executive mansion.
Right.
John Adams was the first president to actually spend a night in the executive mansion.
And that was what the first, that was the name they gave the White House before
right.
it was the
right.
White House, right?
It really didn't become the White House until Teddy Roosevelt coined that phrase
okay.
a number of years later.
All right.
I think it had been called the White House periodically because it was always
painted
white, right?
Yeah.
But it didn't officially become that. That's accredited to Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay.
But so the first president that really spent a night there was John Adams, and it wasn't even done then.
Right.
So Washington never spent a night there. In fact, he was in New York and Philadelphia, the first two capitals before Washington became the town of Washington became the capital of the United States, and it wasn't the District of Columbia yet. That
right.
came a little bit later on. So Adams only spent a few months there before his term was out. He only spent one term as president. So Jefferson was the first president to really spend a full term in the White House.
Do you know if the people were allowed to vote who lived in Washington before it was Washington, D.C.?
I think they were, probably.
I would guess they were.
I would assume that they were either part of my guess would be part of Maryland.
Okay.
Because, you know, you're right there.
Well, they don't have any elected representation
and
now.
And I don't remember what year the District of Columbia was formed. I'll have to check that out.
I don't know that
either. I don't know that either. But anyway, a lot of things have happened in that building over the years. Of course, we know that when Harry Truman was president, the building was in such poor shape. The floors were sagging. Plaster was falling off the wall. I mean, it was in really, really bad shape. That he had the building completely gutted. I mean, completely gutted. There are photographs of that building when Truman was in office. And by the way, he spent his part of his time at the Blair House.
Yeah, across the street.
His official residence across the street, right. But there are photographs that you could probably pull up and see on the internet that show that building when he was president.
I've seen
gutted. There's dump trucks.
Steam shovels in the middle of it.
Yeah. Because it went all the way down to, because there's like three different levels of basement in that place.
Yeah.
But he had the place completely gutted because it was in that bad shape. So all that was left there was a shell. Because you got to remember, during the War of 1812, the British burnt it.
Yeah.
And
the only thing that left after that was the shell.
Yeah. Was a
the
shell.
The walls. Yeah.
So construction in 1801 and construction in 1812, 1813, by the time Truman gets in office in the 50s, construction has changed a lot.
Yeah.
Plus
it's all wood.
Plus there were additions added onto the White House, you know, the West Wing and some of the other additions. So it's changed tremendously over the years.
Yeah.
So progress at the White House. Electrician Ike Hoover came to the mansion in 1891 on behalf of the Edison Company.
Any relation to Herbert Hoover or any of the other Hoovers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
The Edison Company, which had been engaged to install the first electric lights in the White House.
Cool. About what time was that? What
year? 1891.
91.
1891. He was on the job for 4 months, and he installed both the electric light wiring and the electric call bell system that was put in the White House.
Okay.
So they had no way of communicating in the White House other than running up and down the stairs.
So it wasn't like Downton Abbey where they had the bells that rang.
Well, they may have had bells that would have been controlled by cords, but this was
cords.
An electric bell system
okay.
that was set up. So the official White House occupants at the time, the Benjamin Harrisons, were completely inept about dealing with these modern sciences. In fact, they were afraid to turn the switches on and off. Now Benjamin Harrison, my reenactor that portrays Benjamin Harrison, and you've seen him, he uses this information in some of the talks that he gives that talks about that. They were afraid of being shocked.
Yeah.
If they turned the switch to turn the white lights off.
Well, you remember when you learned how to use a computer, you were
kind
of scared about the computer.
Yeah. You were afraid to push this button for free, you might screw it all up.
Blow it up or something, yeah.
So the Harrisons were afraid to turn the lights off. So Hoover later recalled for a long time, the president's family simply wouldn't use the lights that were up in the family quarters. They wouldn't turn the switches off. They were simply afraid.
Kept candles going,
I guess. Were still using kerosene lamps.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So Hoover himself had to turn the lights on in the halls and the parlors, or they wouldn't have been on. And if he didn't come and turn them off, they'd burn all night because the Harrisons were literally afraid to shut them off. So he had to come back the next morning to see if the lights were turned off or stay late enough to turn them off before it got dark.
Well, I guess I understand
that.
It's
crazy, yeah. But you got to put yourself in their shoes, you know. Electricity. Oh, my God. You know, all they're used to seeing is flashes of lightning.
Yeah.
And that's electricity, and that can kill you.
And hear stories about Ben Franklin.
Sure. So, anyway. So, now, as for the electric call bells, perish the thought. Hoover recollected that the family were even timid about pushing those buttons to use the call buttons. So, there again, they didn't use that for a long time. Finally, he held a conference with the family and said, look, you know, this is going to hurt you. Went over it, told them what to do and how to use it before they would actually finally use it. Ike Hoover was so helpful that he stayed on and on and on. He soon joined the ushering staff, and that's where we remember Ike Hoover from.
Okay.
He was chief usher.
Oh, okay.
For a number of years.
What does chief usher do?
He was in charge of the White House staff.
Okay.
The complete staff. That's the kitchen staff, the maids, you know, the upstairs, downstairs maids.
Yeah, gotcha.
All the guys that open the doors and all that.
The guy with the deep voice on Downton Abbey. Okay.
He's kind of the head guy for the help.
Yeah.
Anyway,
can you say that anymore?
What's
I don't think you can call them the help anymore.
No,
I think that's against the rules.
Probably
okay,
not. But they still have of course the chief usher in the White House staff. But later on, he wrote a book called 42 Years in the White House. So he spent 42 years from 1891 until 42 years later. But it all started with the addition of the electric lights and electric call bell system.
Huh.
Yeah. The John Adams's outdoor privy was replaced by Thomas Jefferson's indoor water closet. Now, a water closet in Jefferson's day, you probably have seen these in older homes, where the water tank is above the toilet.
I have
and
seen
it
that.
Works on gravity.
Yeah.
And on the roof of the property on the house would be a large tank like a cistern.
Yeah.
Only an exposed tank that would collect rainwater.
Right.
And that's what serviced the toilets.
Oh, okay.
So and those were simply in a closet that had been converted to a toilet. Yeah.
And where did it go? I assume it went to some sort of what do they call it?
Well, eventually it went to a septic system. Yeah. But when Adams and Jefferson were in the White House and clear up until it went out into the river.
Yeah, guys.
It went out into Washington was basically a swamp.
Yeah.
In those days.
Yeah.
Theoretically it was nothing but a swamp and was mud most of the time. It only dried up in the summertime when it got to be 100 degrees out.
Yeah.
So it just went out, seeped into the yard, and eventually got into the Rappahannock or the Potomac River.
Didn't even have septic tanks. Huh?
Not then. Not then. Which, of course, what also did it get into? Their drinking water supply.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So hence we had a lot of diphtheria and a lot of stuff like that was taking place. Iron stoves were also installed during Jefferson's time, right toward the end of his tenure of office. When Martin Van Buren was there in the 1830s, they had a rudimentary type of heating system. They were still using, for the most part, fireplaces, but by that time they had installed some iron stoves, kind of like potbelly stoves, which was their heating system. Teddy Roosevelt is the individual that built the enclosed West Wing, which includes the Oval Office. Right.
Huh.
So there wasn't really an Oval Office until Teddy Roosevelt built that West Wing. Up until that time, most of the presidents had offices in different places throughout the executive mansion.
Now, as you're looking at the White House in the normal publicity photo that you see, the West Wing is over to the right, is
exactly,
it not?
To the west. Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't know it's west when you're looking at the front. Yeah.
And when he did that, did away with the old greenhouses that were next to the White House.
So I didn't know there were greenhouses.
If you look at a photograph of the White House prior to Teddy Roosevelt's tenure, they were still there when McKinley was there. But if you look at a photograph of the White House when Lincoln was in there, you'll see the greenhouses.
Huh.
And they took in about the same amount of territory that the West Wing took in.
Huh.
Yeah.
So. Cool.
Calvin Coolidge moved out to be out of the way while the shaky attic and roof were replaced with an entire fully livable third floor. So the third floor was basically the attic until Coolidge's tenure.
Okay.
And that was complete with a sky parlor or a sunroom above the south portico of the White House.
Okay.
A quiet retreat where ever since the presidential folk could go to view the Washington vistas up above. Coolidge also shook things up when he shucked the traditional morning coat in favor of a dark businessman suit for normal work days.
So they wore morning coats up until that time,
right. Mm-hmm. Which is also called a frock coat.
Yeah, what I wore in my wedding, as a matter of fact.
Now, at this juncture, I will mention, and this is especially important for more modern-day presidents, I will say like from probably Truman on up. Ronald Reagan never appeared in the Oval Office without a complete suit and tie on.
Was that mandated? Or
no, it was out of his respect for the office.
I got you.
If you look back, there are pictures of Clinton, there are pictures of the Bushes, there are pictures of basically every president from Truman on up, at one point or another, taken in the Oval Office in casual clothes.
Huh.
But there are no photographs none of Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office without a suit and tie on. He wouldn't be photographed that way.
Well, that's kind of interesting, yeah.
And it, again, it was out of respect to the office. But yeah, Calvin Coolidge
wish more people had respect for the office.
Yeah.
But we can leave that one for another discussion.
You know, some presidents even bring rappers into the Oval Office. So anyway, he was the one that that got away from the morning coat or the frock coat, as we refer to him.
Yeah.
So, Andrew Johnson was the first president that installed a barber's chair in the White House.
Where did he do that?
I don't. Doesn't specifically say
where,
in here, but he had a barber's chair installed so he could get a haircut in the White House without having to go out.
It's a good idea.
Up until that time, I would assume that they either had to walk down the street somewhere and get a haircut,
or their wife clipped it.
Andrew Jackson, a running water project was initiated, and what an intricate job that proved to be. Until then, the White House had relied strictly upon two wells. Situated between the main structure and the low side wings that Jefferson had added on.
Huh.
So that comes back to those outdoor privies.
Yeah.
And the water closets where the water was just flushed out into the yard.
Yikes.
Or out in, you know, some tile system.
I'm trying to remember if there's a body of water near the White House.
Well, the Potomac isn't that far away.
But it's still blocks away.
Yeah,
It's not real close.
And the only reason I say that is because John Quincy Adams used to walk down to the Potomac River frequently from the Executive Mansion and skinny dip.
Is that right?
Yeah, he loved to skinny dip in the morning. In fact, and this is probably included in one of my stories later on, but I'll tell it anyway since I happened to stumble onto that. Excuse me, on the day of his election, not election, on the day of his inauguration, early in the morning, he snuck away from the Executive Mansion, went down to the Potomac to take a skinny dip, and one of the local reporters caught him, a female.
Oh, jeez.
And she wanted an interview, and so she followed him down to the river, knowing what he was planning to do, because it was common knowledge that he did that. And so she hid his clothes behind the bush so that he couldn't come out until she got the interview.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, so... A lot of crazy stuff like
that
went on. During Jackson's tenure, engineer Robert Leakey devised and built the complex water delivery system with the help of gravity, and that would supply water to the White House and nearby public buildings such as the Treasury and the State Department or the War Department.
So they must have taken rainwater and brought it in?
Same premise.
Okay.
Yeah, same
a lot premise. Better than the diphtheria-laden stuff. Wells,
right,
yes.
Exactly. By this plan, water was sent coursing through iron pipes from a spring at Franklin Square to three brick-lined, sand-bottomed reservoir or holding pounds. Kind of like an in-ground cistern,
you might
say. Here the piping surfaced to spew out the water as fountains that served to keep the reservoirs properly stirred up and the waters treated. So they were using aeration. Basically to do that. Gravity had carried the water downhill to this point, but when the water moved from the reservoirs into the nearby buildings, it took constant hand pumping by an attendant at the ponds to achieve the pressure necessary to push the water uphill through the internal piping.
Oh, jeez.
So you got guys down there 24/7.
Pumping away.
Hand pumping. Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Bringing the water up. Much like you would get if you had a windmill above a well that used water or used air power to pull the water up through the piping. Yeah, same type of thing.
There probably wasn't a whole lot of wind power available. If I remember the White House, I used to live out there. If I remember the White House, it was pretty well surrounded by hills and stuff.
Oh, yeah,
like
right.
Yeah, so.
yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. That job took about a year to reach completion, but the result was a real luxury for that era, as you can imagine. We're talking, you know, the 1830s, basically. Moreover, it wasn't long before Jackson then installed the bathing room. In the ground level east wing with hot and cold baths and a shower. And again, this water was heated by coal fires by that time they had a boiler system.
And somebody had to keep that going too.
So they were shoveling coal 24/7 in the winter months of the fall.
Yeah.
Jackson also installed a fine brick and stucco stable southeast of the house to replace kind of an old arrangement that had been there when Jefferson was living there.
I'm trying to look at...
Because Jackson kept horses, obviously.
I'm trying to get my mind on where that is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it would be on the east side. The east side of the building, right? No, the west side of the building.
Well, you said south, too.
Yeah, and
so
south.
So it would be
right.
Southeast.
Yeah, yeah, southeast.
Southwest.
progress. There would be other improvements over the years as history moved on. A lot of things, of course, we take for granted today. Freezers. Of course, cars, telephones, a lot of things that they didn't have in the early days that started to appear in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Yeah, okay, we've moved farther forward with freezers, yeah.
And then things that we might tend to forget, like the bomb shelters that were built under the lawn during World War II.
Is that right?
Yeah, there were bomb shelters actually built.
Are they still there?
Don't know. I would imagine that they probably are because they still utilize a lot of those lower sections for security systems and for meeting rooms, like when there's a disaster. And especially, I would imagine that's a place that they can go now if there's an alert.
Yeah.
Now, back years ago, prior to World War II, and that was right about the time that these were built, at the Greenbrier down in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia.
Yep, yep.
They built what do they call that? I can't remember what it's called now. Anyway, they built this whole complex underneath the mountain and attached it to the Greenbrier Hotel.
Oh, I didn't
know that. So that in the event of a disaster, they could take the entire Congress, both the House and the Senate, and move them by train to White Sulphur Springs and put them under this mountain. And they were, and I've toured it.
Huh.
I've been there. It wasn't open until just about 10 years ago. It wasn't open to the public because they were still actually
possibly using it. Yeah.
Right. But now it's been open to the public. But when you go in, extremely interesting. If you ever get a chance, any of our listeners, if you ever get a chance, go to the Greenbrier. You don't have to stay at the Greenbrier. You can take just a tour of the bunker. They call it the bunker. That's what they call it, the bunker.
Okay.
You can take a tour of it. It's extremely interesting. They have a – you go into this big general room to start with, and then there's an enormous, huge steel door that must be 10 feet thick.
Oh, my.
That opens and closes, and it's big enough that trucks can drive through it because they would bring supplies and so forth in. But there's an individual room set up to look like the Senate chambers. There's an individual room that will hold 100 senators. There's another individual room that would look like the House chambers that would have enough seats for the, 435 members.
Yeah, something like that.
There are murals on the wall that show the Capitol building. Or the White House that a senator or a congressman could stand in front of if there were still broadcasting capabilities available,
right.
If they had been knocked out by nuclear bombs.
Make it look
like they
were there.
Or they could broadcast it, make it look like they were still in Washington so that the government was still going on. There are decontamination rooms where the senators and the congressmen coming in would have to disrobe, go through this decontaminating chamber where they would be showered with a certain type of material to get any kind of nuclear waste off of them, and that everyone would wear the same type of a coverall type uniform and would be identified by a badge as to who they were. There's a huge cafeteria facility in there.
Well, they'd have to be, yeah.
And they had to eat in shifts. Dormitories with regular bunk beds.
It must be gigantic.
It's huge. It's huge. The tours takes a couple hours.
Oh, my.
To go through. But the bunk beds, so that, you know, you were sharing a big dormitory with maybe 100 people, and you were sleeping in bunk beds. Congressmen and senators now, mind you.
And senatorettes? Female senatorettes.
If there were any then. Yeah, if there were any then. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
So, but a very, very interesting facility to tour.
Does sound interesting. The thing that would scare me is it's underneath a mountain. What if the mountain comes down? They're all squished.
Well, supposedly the premise was that the mountain was thick enough and was granite that it could withstand unless it was a direct hit.
Yeah.
it could withstand a nuclear explosion within half a mile away.
Oh, cool.
And if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know it was there.
Huh.
Because to get to it, of course, you have to go through the hotel. And you're walking down this corridor with doors here and there and so forth. And here's this enormous, here's this wall with like a mural or paintings and things on it like that. And that opens up.
The whole wall, huh?
And that takes you back into,
yeah, I'll be there.
And you would never know it was there.
Sounds interesting.
It really is. It's called The Bunker, and it's attached to the Greenbrier Hotel, White Sulphur Springs, West
Virginia. Well, when I get my RV tomorrow.
Yeah, I heard about that yesterday on the radio. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that we'll get it. I'm going to look at it this afternoon.
Is it someone that has one for sale? Or
no, it's a dealer.
A dealership?
Yeah. So it's the only way I can get the bank to do it.
Yeah, well, that's understandable.
Yeah. All right.
That's just some of the progress that's taken place, of course, over the years in the White House. And we know there's other things that have gone on there over the years. Like I said, when Truman, we did mention briefly about Truman when he was there. I don't remember how long that whole thing took. I think it took over a year to do that.
But, and then he was followed not too long after that with Mrs. Kennedy, who completely
did the inside.
Restyled the inside.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because basically he didn't do anything with the accoutrements. Mm-hmm. He was more interested in the structure itself.
Making sure you didn't fall
literally,
through the floor.
Literally, the floors yeah. were sagging in there.
Yeah.
They actually had quit using some of the elevators because they were in such bad shape.
Yikes.
So, I mean, it really needed a big general makeover.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. One of the other things that I thought was kind of interesting, who all has been married in the White House?
Oh, that would be quite interesting.
So I got a whole section on that, too, that we'll talk about. And that's probably going to take us up to...
We know that James Buchanan was not.
James Buchanan was not, that's true.
All right. Yeah.
So, and again, I don't think these are in any particular chronological order. It's just the way that... That the book had him arranged. So, John Quincy Adams' son, John Adams II. Now we're talking about John Quincy Adams,
right?
John Adams is John Adams' son.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. His son, John Adams II, and his brothers, and his brother George's one-time fiance, Mary Catherine, were married there in 1828.
So these are not necessarily presidents that were married there, but anybody.
Other people,
that, yeah,
right.
I got you.
Other people,
right.
Presidents included. Presidents. Well, actually, the only president that's been married in the White House was Grover Cleveland.
Okay.
But that would include sons, daughters, relatives, and I think there is one non-relative, non-connected to the White House person.
A big donor to some president.
Don't think they were particularly... I've got the story here someplace. I think it's in this section. But
right.
And then they spent their honeymoon in the White House as well.
That would be nice, yeah.
Of course, we're all old enough to remember when Lyndon Baird Johnson married Charles Robb in December of 1967.
Well, not all of us, but you and I are.
Well, definitely you and I, yeah. Maybe some of our listeners wouldn't be old enough to remember that, but... like many another young wife, Lyndon Baird then had to watch her Marine Corps officer husband go off to war. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Right after, and this was Vietnam.
Yeah.
So literally right after the ceremony, he walked out, got on a helicopter, and flew to Andrews Air Force Base.
Where he went to? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet he had pretty decent duty, though.
Well, up until...
and he was an officer. So.
Yeah, up until the time that her dad decided not to run for re-election then. Of course, his duty might have changed. Linda returned from seeing off Chuck in late March of 1968 looking like a ghost. She was pale, tall, and drooping, said her mother. Rob, once assigned to the White House as a social aide, came back unscathed from Vietnam and won election as lieutenant governor and then governor of Virginia and then became a U.S. senator from
Virginia. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I do remember that. Richard Nixon's daughter, Tricia, married Edward Cox.
Not a handsome woman, but...
No. not particularly, no. Who set a new precedent in June of 1971 as the first couple to be married at the White House, but outside of the White House, in the Rose Garden, right?
Yeah.
They got married in the Rose Garden.
Or what they refer to now as the soccer pitch.
Yes, right, absolutely. Only 400 guests and onlookers could squeeze into the garden confines. And it rained that day, which delayed the ceremony until Trisha Nixon made the decision to brave the elements and proceed as planned. So they went ahead and had it. UPI's veteran White House correspondent and Scott's friend Helen Thomas was the reporter that was allowed there.
And quite a feisty one she was.
She was petite and exquisite in white lace as she came down the aisle on her father's arm, still in the Rose Garden. Not Helen.
Yeah.
wet chairs, but no more rain. So they did have to dry off the chairs for the visiting people attending. And I remember that wedding.
I kind of do,
quite well. If I remember correctly, they showed a portion of it on the television, if I remember
right. I think that's what I remember
This is interesting. This is very interesting. A guest at Trisha's wedding was Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter Alice.
Really?
Who was causing trouble all the time when he was in the White House and beyond.
How did she have a relationship? Just because she was the president's daughter?
Two reasons.
Okay.
She was Teddy Roosevelt's daughter, obviously.
Yeah, I understand
but
that.
But her husband, and I forget his, what was his first name? Alan Longworth? That doesn't sound right. Anyway, her husband was a congressman from Ohio.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was from Cincinnati.
I'll be there.
So, for two reasons, I would assume. Theodore Roosevelt's daughter herself, one of the first persons ever married in the White House, so she was married in the White House as well. Her wedding was in 1906. Not a bit, she exclaimed, comparable to what Nixon's daughter had, though. She said, "I was married 20 years before Hollywood." This wedding of Nixon's was quite a production. Actually, hers was also quite a production. It took place in the East Room of the White House. And the service was conducted by a bishop. They weren't Catholic, but maybe an Episcopalian bishop.
Yeah, it could have been,
The altar was adorned with gold cloth and decorated
dad was
with
in,
Easter lilies.
My dad was in the running to become the bishop of the Methodist Church. So
it
could have been
any
bishop.
Yeah, that's true. I guess they do. Well, speaking from a Catholic, that's a good thing I think of.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Looking on were diplomats and members of her father's cabinets, along with the socially prominent family members and friends. One high point of sorts came when the irrepressible Alice borrowed an officer's dress uniform sword to cut the wedding cake.
Oh, my. You know, I think I remember that. Yeah, I think I remember pictures of
that. You have to remember Alice. She was President Roosevelt's oldest daughter, of course, born from his first wife. And for one of the things that she liked to do was sit on the roof of the White House and shoot birds with a .22.
Oh, my.
Roosevelt once said to a reporter, "I can either be president of the United States or watch over my daughter Alice. I can't do both."
Well, she learned how
That's
to
a
shoot.
Quote.
She learned how to shoot birds from her dad.
Yeah, absolutely,
probably.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
He was quite honored.
Nicholas was Longworth's first name. Nicholas Longworth, and he actually went on to become Speaker of the House, if I remember correctly. But he was from Cincinnati. Yeah. And you know, she lived. She was still living, obviously she was still living clear up into Nixon, but I think she died. I think Johnson had been elected president before she finally died.
Huh.
Yeah, so she was in her 90s before she died. Florence Harding once said of Alice Roosevelt Longworth, "If any woman ever deserved the title of a bitch, it was her."
Oh, a little crude and rude.
That's a quote from Mrs. Harding.
I'll be darned.
And she truly was. But you know, practically every president from Wilson on sought her counsel.
Well, sometimes you need a bitch to tell you
the
truth.
Well, she became like an elder statesman, kind of like what Eleanor Roosevelt was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was a wealth of information, and she knew about what was going on in town. And she still held gala parties clear up into the time she died. And it was a sought-after invitation to be invited to one of Alice Roosevelt's
How
parties.
Do you think she found out what was going on?
Absolutely. She knew all the gossip.
Yeah.
Another. What are we doing on time?
We got 13 minutes.
Okay. Another president's daughter married in the East Room was Ulysses S. Grant's daughter, Nellie.
Oh, I didn't know he had children.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. She was married in the East Room. Her husband's name was Algernon Satoris. He was from England, and he was kind of a wealthy, not royalty, but similar to royalty.
It certainly doesn't sound English.
No, but that was his name. Algernon Satoris, S-A-R-T-O-R-I-S. Hmm. And that was in 1874 beneath a huge bell of flowers set off by orange blossoms imported from the South to decorate the large room. And again, they were married in the East Room at the White House. Slices of the wedding cake were put up in little white boxes about 6 inches long and 3 inches wide. And this information came from the doorkeeper at the time, Thomas Pendell. It was his job to pass out the wedding cake to the ladies in the nearby red parlor.
Hmm. Now,
so you wonder who paid for all this.
Yeah, you know, well, we did.
They always say it wasn't done at public expense, but I kind of
I can't imagine it wasn't. Yeah. Was there any sort of regulations they had to go through, any sort of paperwork they had to go through to have a wedding in the White House?
No, just not to my knowledge.
If Dad says
if the
it's
big
okay,
guy
we're
says
doing
it's happening, it happens.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Now, of course, security-wise, for some of the later weddings that took place, like Nixon's and Johnson's, security would have been a lot more than what would have been when Alice Roosevelt was elected. Because, again, when Roosevelt was in the White House, you could still walk up to the front door and knock on the door, and you might get to see the president.
Pretty.
In fact, when Lincoln was in office... just outside of where his office was a big long hallway, and it was lined with chairs. And if you wanted to see the president, you went in, gave the doorman your name. It was passed on to either John Hay or Nicolay, the two secretaries for Lincoln. You sat down in a wooden chair, and when it was your turn, Nicolay or Hay would come out and announce your name and take you down to see Lincoln.
Now, when I was in the Army Field Band, you could still... you couldn't knock on the front door of the White House, but you could go to the East Wing and go in.
And get in.
Yeah. And there was no guard around it or anything. Yeah. Yeah. You did have to knock. You had to get in.
Again, I think a lot of this, a lot of the security portion of it started with World War II, obviously, especially with the White House itself. But in most cases, the very early presidents, they were entirely accessible to the to the general public.
Do they really have anti-aircraft guns on the roof?
I can't say.
Well, I thought
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
That I can't really say. And probably they deny it if you ask.
Yeah, probably will.
But when you stop to think, when you stop and think back, I know we'll touch on this later on. We talk about Andrew Jackson. But when Jackson was inaugurated, they basically opened the door to the White House and let anybody and everybody in. And you and the rednecks that came up from Tennessee to see Jackson inaugurated.
I don't think you can say that anymore.
Well, that's what they were called. They flooded in. Uh-huh. They literally tore the place up.
Wow.
And a lot of furniture and crap got carried off.
Sounds like
the place was a mess afterwards.
Sounds like January 6th.
That was Jackson. You know, that was. But this was a nice party. You know?
Yeah,
they weren't beating anybody up or anything like that.
Or killing
anybody.
Just
out there. They were just out there having a good time. You know, because
had their
Jackson,
moonshine with them.
Well, you know,
probably.
Old Hickory. He was kind of a rogue himself.
Yes, he was.
So yeah, they had a big party that completely destroyed the inside of the White House. Yeah,
wow,
unreal. Yeah.
We're down to about 9 minutes.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, we got enough time to cover, I think.
Okay.
Only one presidential family saw two daughters that were married in the White House, and that was Woodrow Wilson's family.
Oh.
One of the weddings was a grand affair with thousands of guests, and the other, just a few months later, was a more intimate family-style wedding.
Huh.
The first Wilson daughter to make White House nuptials history was young Jessie, who was married the evening of November the 25th, 1913, to Francis Sayer. And he was an assistant district attorney in New York City. Their vows were exchanged in the East Room, and the throngs of guests were received afterward in the Blue Room and then offered refreshments in the State Dining Room. So they used several rooms in the White House. Next came Sister Nell, who surprised all of the family by falling in love with a widowed member of her father's cabinet, Treasury Secretary William McAdoo, who was 26 years older.
I was going to say, I'm sure he was older.
And I remember Treasury Secretary William McAdoo from other readings about the Woodson administration. He was a very prominent part of that administration early on. Of course, Wilson had two terms.
Yeah.
Treasury Secretary William McAdoo and Nell's wedding took place in the Blue Room on May 7th of 1914. And during the ceremony, McAdoo's oldest daughter, Nona, became hysterical and had to be led away for whatever reason. I don't know whether she was upset because her father was marrying somebody that was
her own age.
Or what. Later, Nell and her new husband dodged reporters by leaving from the South Portico in the fifth car to pass through the gate so that reporters wouldn't recognize them. By then, the awaiting reporters had all gone after the wrong cars. As Nell left, she looked back and saw her mother and father standing hand in hand, and she later said that I horrified my husband by breaking into tears in the darkness of the car. The next time she saw her mother, Ellen Wilson, was in late May after Ellen had fallen ill and taken a fall and became ill. In bed when Nell returned from her honeymoon, she had changed. She looked very small and white, and her color was gone. Of course, she died very soon after that. You know? And I think she had tuberculosis, if I remember correctly. Tuberculosis and her organs started to shut down.
Yeah.
But then, of course, Wilson remarried just a little less than a year later. As for the one and only president's wedding to take place in the White House, the hour was 7 o'clock in the evening. The day was June the 2nd of 1886. As mentioned elsewhere, the groom was Grover Cleveland. I talked about Grover Cleveland earlier, and his bride, Frances. He called her Frank. Folsom. Her father was his, as I mentioned before, was his her late father's law partner when they were in Buffalo. She was a college graduate, and as I mentioned earlier,
which
is very unusual in the 1880s. And as I mentioned earlier, when she was born, her father asked Grover Cleveland to be her godfather. So he was actually her godfather when they were married. And then when her father died, Cleveland stepped in to make sure that she and her mother were taken care of financially and looked after until she became of age and then went off to college. Hmm. And then, of course, eventually they developed a romantic relationship. Eight marriages had preceded Cleveland's within the White House, but none, of course, featured a president. So he was the first and only president to be married in the White House. Cleveland himself walked the bride down the grand staircase to the wedding march, along the transverse hall, the first floor, and into the blue parlor of that era. I'm not sure what that would be now. Maybe just a blue room.
I don't know. I was wondering that earlier. Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah. I'm not sure if that's the same thing or not. He wore black evening clothes with a white lawn necktie and white rose in his lapel. Her wedding gown with a four-yard train.
Wow.
What is that, 12 feet?
Yeah.
A 12-foot-long train was decorated with orange blossoms. The ceremony in the blue parlor was followed by a wedding supper served in the East Room, where the chief decorations were a full-rigged ship comprised of flowers, roses, pansies, pinks, and set on a mirror in the center of the main table, intended as the ship's sea.
I assume it was a fake ship.
Although Cleveland did like to sail. In fact, I got a story about that.
Cool.
I'll tell you. Guests received their slice of historic wedding cake in a small white satin box containing a card autographed by the happy couple. Since the White House was really theirs, they could have honeymooned on the spot, like John Adams did in 1828, but they chose not to do so. They slipped away that very evening on a special train that took them up to a hideaway in the Alleghenies.
Now,
as I said, Cleveland liked to sail, and he used the presidential yacht.
Oh, there is a presidential
yacht. Oh, yeah. There was a presidential yacht that was used clear up. I think Truman might have been the one that retired the presidential yacht. Truman or Eisenhower, one of the two. But the early presidents used a lot. There were a couple of them. I can't remember the names. I used to know the names. I can't remember the names. But Cleveland most of them used it on the Potomac River.
Sure.
However, Cleveland was known to take it up and use it on the Rappahannock too. And there were some cases where it actually was that would wind its way out into the ocean too. So it was actually used quite
pretty
a bit.
Pretty big then. Yeah.
As I mentioned earlier, I think I might have said this earlier on. Maybe it was before we went on air. But Cleveland developed a lump inside his mouth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The roof of his mouth. And they determined that it was cancerous. He didn't want the general public to know about it. So he and the doctors and the surgeon that were going to perform the surgery actually went on the presidential yacht. And they performed the surgery while the yacht was on the Potomac River.
I'm not sure I want to have surgery done on me with a yacht bouncing around on the waves.
They did. Yeah. They did. And they successfully removed a tumor from the roof of his mouth. I think they said it was somewhere in the neighborhood of walnut size that they took.
Yeah. I hope it was a very calm day.
Well, I didn't hear that there were any problems from it, from what I've read. I've been trying to find this book that was written primarily about Cleveland so I could give it to the gal that's going to be doing Francis Cleveland. I haven't been able to find it in my stash. There was quite an interesting story in the book about the surgery and about the whole episode.
We're down to 1 minute.
Oh, okay. Well,
we can continue, and I'm sure
absolutely.
We will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we've got this book takes us all the way up to Obama.
Oh, so it's fairly recent book.
I'm going to say we've got at least two more.
All right.
Two more times together that we'll work on these stories.
Sounds good to me. Well, we will be talking about all the events that are going on with the Marion Historical
Society. Especially if you mention that one about the week from this Thursday.
Yes, I will.
Today.
Yeah. And for those of you who are listening, we will go to Swap Shop here in about – no, we're not going to Swap Shop. We're just – what are we going to next? Yes, Swap Shop. And we'll bring those back up for you so you get those dates. And thanks for listening. We'll be back. Fred will be back in about a month. Have a good day, and
You're
I'll be back in 15 minutes.
WGH Radio 107.1 LP.